This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, happy Earth Day. I'm Laura Lynch, the host of What on Earth. It's a podcast that brings you a world of climate solutions. Our team is great at finding inspiration in unexpected places, analyzing new technologies, and generally living up to our motto, the climate is changing, so are we. And today we wanted to share with you an episode we're proud of. It tells the story of the first Earth Day in 1970 from one of its founders, an OG, although this OG seems to think that stands for old geezer. He's funny, frank, and wise about the past and future. Then we look ahead to what's next with some rising stars in this generation of climate organizers. Have a listen. Come with me back in time. It's April 1970. The Vietnam War is dragging on, and Americans are becoming increasingly disillusioned with the United States' involvement in that conflict. Yet even as anti-war protests grow, another movement is springing up across the country.
Even if that war were over tomorrow, we would still be killing this planet. We are systematically destroying our land, our streams, and our seas. We foul our air, deaden our senses, and pollute our bodies. And it's getting worse.
Now that voice you're listening to there, that's Dennis Hayes from coverage by CBS News of that day. Dennis, you are right here. So what is it like to hear that after all this time?
My goodness, I sound like a politician. I guess that's what a microphone does when you've got a stage. Well, 1970 was quite remarkable, but I'm not sure where CBS recorded that, but that might have been in Manhattan, which was the key event of the day. We had a million people. Merrill Lindsay had shut down Fifth Avenue, and it was jammed with people for like 40 blocks.
For 2 hours, fashionable Fifth Avenue was off limits to automobiles and became a crowded pedestrian mall.
It was the most amazing experience of my life. We thought it was going to be a good-sized event, but here you're looking out at a sea of faces that stretches out farther than the eye can see, and suddenly realize we had something that could be big and powerful.
All right, now I've created a bit of a mystery for listeners. Maybe you better let listeners know why you were there giving that speech.
Well, this was the first Earth Day back in 1970, and it was at a time when we were beginning to now tie everything from nuclear fallout to pesticides to air pollution and water pollution to threats to the biosphere and endangered species, and tie it all up into a package that would bring forth a pretty revolutionary set of changes in policy if we were going to be protecting every aspect of the planet. It was a really amazing event for a 25-year-old kid.
Well, I think Dennis is actually being a bit modest here because he wasn't just any 25-year-old kid. He was a 25-year-old who organized the very first Earth Day. I'm Laura Lynch, and this is What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. And today, we're diving into the radical origins of Earth Day with the OG of the movement. And we ask, does it still matter to a new generation of climate fighters? It started more than 50 years ago when U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson came up with the idea for environmental teach-ins on university campuses. Then he met with young Dennis Hayes, and he must have liked him, because he asked him to get involved. Dennis had no idea what he was saying yes to.
Good evening. On this Earth Day, millions of Americans in the communities which dot this map have taken the first step to survival. But if this day of teach-ins, mock funerals, rallies, marches, speeches, and songs does not convince enough of us that the threat to our life on Earth is clear and present, then we may have cast a vote for death.
Now, Dennis Hayes, you've been at this in one way or another for decades. What do you think when you hear that report from ABC News?
That we were finally reaching a point where people were paying attention broadly to the threats to the planet. For the most part, before that, even within the environmental movement, things were relatively narrow. There were people who cared about air pollution or who cared about nuclear power, or cared about saving the whales. cared about stopping a freeway that was going to bisect their neighborhood. But they thought of themselves as freeway people or whale people or air pollution people. And what Earth Day did was to tie all of those individual strands together into one broader fabric of environmentalism. And by bringing all of those different forces together, it became a much more powerful political entity than it was when just narrowly focused.
Let's talk about how you got to that point a little bit more. As you said, you were quite young. You're in your 20s organizing this. Where were you living and what were you studying?
That's ironic. I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and in a program at Harvard in the Kennedy School, where I was required to do something to try to influence public policy.
Oh, this was a school assignment, was it?
Yes.
Okay.
This was 1969, and all of us were relatively activist, and I wanted to do something that was not quite that bureaucratic and expected. And so when I heard of this concept of an environmental teach-in, I had already some years earlier decided I wanted to devote my life to environmental values. So I flew down to Washington and with all the arrogance of youth, got a 15-minute courtesy appointment with Senator Nelson to find out about this environmental teach-in, with the thought that perhaps I would go back and organize Harvard. So I went back home to organize all of Boston and got a call 2 days later asking whether I'd be willing to drop out of school and come down and organize the United States.
Oh, wow. And how was the arrogance of youth at that point?
Yeah, ironically, this was a brand new program that Harvard had spent 3 years designing. It had only 12 students in it for the initial class. And three of them dropped out with me to go down and work on Earth Day.
Ouch.
It was a long time when my name was just mud at Harvard.
I bet it's not anymore. So tell me a little bit about then what you did, how you made it become more than a teach-in.
Well, it's important to realize that there were no computers, there were no cell phones, there were certainly no social media. Moving things out now just, it sounds like something from, the covered wagon days. We persuaded a wide variety of different kinds of publications by thinking of something that would be relevant to their readers to run articles about this coming event. And a remarkable number of them put our mailing address or our telephone number in the article in case their readers wanted to contact us. So we broadcast through whatever kind of thing we could find, and then it depended entirely upon people getting back to us, some of whom turned out to be brilliant organizers, some of them turned out to be brilliant letter writers, but they didn't really develop into much. And then we would crank out every couple of weeks a bulletin telling about who's doing what where, what are clever new ideas for something you might do on Earth Day. And then later on, interestingly, the United Auto Workers began to print them for us. The United Auto Workers were our biggest source of financial support for Earth Day.
I read that and I found that fascinating, and I just couldn't imagine that being the case today.
Yeah, I don't think it would be today.
All right, so the stage is set. We'll go back again now to that day. As you said, you were in New York looking out upon the sea of people. You were hearing about what was going on across the country. Could you believe what you had actually pulled off?
Well, after New York, I flew to Chicago, and it wasn't as big as New York, but it was, again, a very large event, and then got back to Washington, D.C. that night. This was before we were concerned about the carbon footprint of travel, and had a tail-end event in Washington, which was, again, a huge event, and the wire service numbers were starting to come in. But when they gave that aggregate total where they tried to pull together everything that they could find from all of their stringers and all of the different communities across the country and came up with the 20 million figure, no, I was just blown away. That was about one out of every 10 Americans was participating in Earth Day.
Now, I'm wondering who at the time were the people who were fighting for the environment? What was their race, class, gender, political affiliations?
At the local level, they were relatively diverse. Among national organizations, we were much less so. It was organizations that tended to be white, middle class, college educated. We reached out fairly aggressively to disadvantaged communities and to their national leaders, all of whom were supportive but wouldn't make us a priority. They'd say, you know, we're facing crime, we're facing drugs, we're facing police abuse, we're facing terrible schools, we're discriminated against in housing, our health is terrible. I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. We live in the most polluted neighborhoods in the city, and we'll get around to that after we take care of these other issues, but this just can't be a priority for us right now.
Earth Day went global in the 1990s. What do you think are some of the big wins for the environment that you credit to Earth Day?
It was a time of the war in Southeast Asia, and most people have forgotten that less than a week after Earth Day, Nixon invaded Cambodia, and the streets just erupted.
The students of the United States engulfed this city today, the culmination of a protest that has been building since the invasion of Cambodia. Tonight, there is tear gas in the streets near the White House.
And within a few days after that, they shot some students.
American students did not accept the president's assurances. And 4 days later, the dissent against his decision turned to tragedy on the campus of Kent State University, Ohio.
2 weeks after Earth Day, nobody was talking about the environment. And then that fall, we launched a Dirty Dozen campaign, went after 12 members of Congress with horrible environmental records. And pretty clearly, the environment was the issue that defeated 7 of 12 incumbents, which is really unusual in American politics. And that really created the context within which the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act et al. were passed. None of that would have happened but for Earth Day.
Right. To keep that issue front and center took a lot of work, and you did not rest on your laurels. You remained active in the environmental movement ever since. And I'm wondering, all through the ensuing years, how has the activism and the issues that people are fighting for changed?
In 1970, the dominant issues were things that could be seen and smelled, and the ones where we got the clearest results from local activisms were local issues. If it's a local power plant that you want to clean up, a particular 12-lane freeway that's going to bust through a disadvantaged community that you want to stop. Today, the issues tend to be much more global, and they tend to be things that you rely upon science to tell you about. I mean, for years, when we were talking about climate change, all we could do was point to lines crossing on a chart sometime out in the future before we got hit with droughts and with hurricanes and with floods and with rising sea levels and things. And even today, to tie those things to the exhaust from an automobile sometimes stretches people's in ways that are difficult for some people to accept. Whereas if you've got a plume coming out of a smokestack and everybody in the neighborhood is coughing, the debate is much easier to win.
What about the activists themselves? How are they different now from those who were leading the charge during the first few decades?
There was an environmental generation of people who got engaged in 1970, say, through 1980, moved into positions of leadership in various organizations and may have stayed there, myself included, longer than we should have. The next generation was somewhat less engaged. We now have a generation coming up that seems to be very much in the spirit of the 1960s, people who care passionately about the war in the Middle East, the war in Ukraine, about climate change, about nuclear proliferation, about the sea of plastics that we're all swimming in, and want to do something to influence and really to shape policy to guarantee themselves a future. So I think today has a lot of resemblance to 1970.
Given what you just described as what this new generation is and what they're up against, how hopeful are you that they'll rise to the challenge and make a difference?
I think we've got a group of people who are well-educated on environmental issues, who are deeply committed to building themselves a sustainable future, and who are fairly sophisticated about how to take advantage of social media and other ways of moving their message aggressively across broad populations.
People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
And a huge difference between 1970 and today is that today we're dealing with global issues, and we have a bunch of young people who are global citizens, digital natives, who are comfortable talking with their peers around the world and capable of building an international movement of, I think, real force.
And what lessons could you give them as they try to apply it to today's fight against climate change?
Thinking back on myself as a youth and my eagerness to hear from some 80-year-old geezer about what lessons you I suspect they are not waiting with bated breath for my pearls of wisdom. But I suppose the most important single thing I would say is don't underestimate yourself. That somebody is going to be rising up to do this. Somebody is either going to have the torch passed to them, or they're going to seize the torch, and it might as well be you.
I think that's pretty good advice, even if it does come from a self-described geezer. I don't agree with that, but Dennis Hayes, I have so enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, Laura.
Well, yeah, this self-described 80-year-old geezer managed to pull off something pretty radical for his time. But it's 2024. Does Earth Day still have that kind of clout now? Or is it time to do some rethinking? I wanted to hear from this generation of climate activists, the people who are seizing that torch from Dennis. So we called up a couple of them. Axel, what do you think a powerful environmental protest looks like now?
You know, a few years ago in Portland, there were climate justice student walkouts. And my sister was in high school. And so I went with her and a number of her friends to these student walkouts. And it was just so inspiring to be positively promoting a vision of what we hope the future can look like. So it's one thing to stand against something, you know, against environmental harm, against environmental degradation, against urban sprawl, against excessive development, against polluting our water and our air, against, you know, continuing to push out greenhouse gases that are impacting the climate. But it's another thing to stand for something. And so maybe I would hope for community-driven, intergenerational celebrations of the vision that we hope to see, like how we want to be living on the Earth.
And Maria, what do you think? Do you have a vision for a re-energized Earth Day?
Yeah, I agree with some of the ideas that Axel has shared already. One thing when I think about Earth Day, of course, this is, you know, raising awareness, but it's also this component of action being brought with it. And a lot of that action is policy. So I think for me, it's thinking of celebrating and coming together, but also coming up with solutions alongside everyone. And most importantly, those who are impacted, but also with those elements of intergenerations coming together from, you know, the past and the current and the future as well.
That is Maria Blancas and Axel Campana. And they think very highly of Dennis Hayes, by the way. They know him because a few years ago, the foundation he chairs awarded them grants for their environmental work. Maria and Axel are climate leaders. They are paving their own path in the wake of Dennis's work and in the process underscoring just how much climate activism is evolving. Maria is from Mexico. She grew up in central Washington state and now teaches at a university in Seattle. She is also
really proud to be the daughter of farm workers. My dad has been a farm worker in the U.S. since he was 14. I think one thing that I've learned from my parents is, you know, hard work and dedication and commitment to each other, but also so much wisdom and pride in being able to work the land and being able to contribute to the food system, which we all recognize is so important. And really, farm workers like my parents are the backbone of the economy and agriculture in the U.S. and globally.
Her parents' challenges inspired Maria to focus on keeping farm workers safe and healthy as the weather heats up and wildfire seasons intensify.
Now, you know, heat and smoke is so present. Workers like my dad, especially in the months of August, because it's, you know, prime harvest season here in the Pacific Northwest, but they're also working, you know, under these high temperatures. And then on top of that, now we have smoke, you know, coming in and complicating things.
So what are the answers then for this? I mean, it is not just happening in Washington State. It happens in lots of other places all over the world. What policy changes do you think are needed to protect farm workers from extreme weather?
You know, some of the solutions is that I've heard from workers is some basic ones like being able to have breaks and shade, and also, you know, PPE to help protect them against the smoke, for example. But also, you know, thinking about how we can change our food system and how we produce agriculture. I think they're, you know, it's really difficult to ignore the contributions of intensive agriculture production in the U.S. And how that's depleted, you know, our soil and our water systems. But I think that those are, you know, larger solutions that could be addressed globally. But I think at the immediate, workers, you know, are deserving of protections in their workplace.
Axel is a graduate student in Portland, Oregon, and he also refers to himself as an environmental justice practitioner. He looks at how some people are hit harder by heat waves because of where they live and how their neighborhoods are built.
So in Portland, and similar to many other cities, we've found that low-income folks who are people of color, folks that they have at most a high school diploma, maybe not, and also linguistically isolated communities are more likely to experience higher heat. And so that what we mean by that is on average, but also when extreme heat events happen, they're the hottest areas in the city. And it's because of uncontrolled development, also less space and for planting trees and also less shade from trees.
So when you're designing an urban space, especially as cities become more dense and more people move in, what do you think needs to be included to make sure that marginalized communities can actually cope with the heat?
We can plant trees, for example. However, a tree is not going to get sizable enough to provide both shade and also nighttime temperature relief for another 20 years at least. So in the medium term, we are building more affordable housing, for example, making sure that affordable housing has space for green space. And then in the long term, I think it's about ensuring that communities that we say we're investing in because they currently live in a specific place actually can stay in that place. For the Black community in particular, I've been really focusing on the Black community because I'm Black. And so it's just helpful to be able to talk with people and continue to build relationships in that way. But something that we've heard is that, you know, when people are displaced, it makes it harder to pass knowledge about how to steward the environment, how to maintain trees from generation to generation. And so ensuring that people can stay and benefit from these investments that are going to take a long time to really reap the benefits of, I think, is important in the long term.
So it seems to me the climate issues that both of you are passionate about are actually quite different from the ones that were dominating the agenda when Dennis Hayes was young. But that spirit seems to be the same, fighting for justice and a better planet. I'm wondering if you can tell me what a successful Earth Day would look like in, say, 2050.
Oh, wow. In 2050. Oh, my goodness. And it's 2024, just to be clear in my head. Like, okay, 2024, 2050. I'm a dreamer, so bear with me. I would love to see that people actually have Earth Day off. Like, we take, like, our commitment to the land and to the earth and to our home seriously enough where we actually provide the space and the time for lots of people to get involved. Because I think currently a lot of people are still dealing with the same things that we have been dealing with for a long time when it comes to the inequity in civic engagement and who can be involved. There are exceptional people who still work a full-time job, have raising a family, and are involved in their community. Those are superheroes. But for the rest of us, we need to incentivize and enable participation if we're going to live in a democratic society that is moving toward not only a future that where we can all live on the planet in a healthy way, but can live well.
And Maria, what do you think? What would a successful Earth Day look like in 2050?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that idea, Axel. I'm with you on having a day off. But I'm also hoping that in 2050, that Earth Day isn't just one day. Maybe it'll be a week. Maybe it could be a month. I don't know.
And do either of you have any plans to celebrate this one in 2024?
Yeah, I'm not a very good planner until the day of. So I'm not going to.
Yeah, I'm actually, I'm excited. I am joining with a local community grassroots organization here. They are having a farm worker march to, again, continue the conversation around farm workers and how we are important to the conversation of environmental justice and climate justice. So I will be marching 7 miles alongside the tulip workers in Skagit Valley.
There you go. Axel Campana and Maria Blancas, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, Earth Day, I think it's actually still okay and even kind of cool to wish people a happy Earth Day. I spend most of my weekends out in the forest, which is kind of like a happy Earth Day anytime I do it. So I kind of have this perpetual celebration of what is all around us that serves us so well. And I think at the very least, if you think about this planet, then you're marking Earth Day for yourselves. And we have a bit of time to catch you up on some other climate stories in the news this week. There are new developments in a story we've been following. The proposed Highway 413 outside of Toronto, its route running through some sensitive habitats, may begin construction within a year. That's if Ontario Premier Doug Ford has his way. The project has been held up by federal insistence on an environmental review and ensuing court battles. But now Ottawa and the province have reached an agreement that could see the roadway built. Still, opponents are vowing to continue the fight to stop the shovels from ever digging into the ground. That is so cute. That is the sound of a black-footed ferret kit or baby. It's posted with a video on the Smithsonian's National Zoo YouTube page, and they're really cute. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has announced the birth of two new baby ferrets cloned from cells frozen nearly 4 decades ago. The ferrets were actually born a year ago, but the service has waited for them to grow before making the births public. The black-footed ferret was once thought to be extinct, but then small numbers of the animal were discovered, so they've shifted it to the endangered species list. The Wildlife Service says restoring healthy populations of these and other endangered species is important, not just to biodiversity in and of itself, but also to the resilience of ecosystems as the climate changes. These two ferrets, named Noreen and Antonia, won't be released into the wild anytime soon. There's hope they'll breed other baby ferrets. And for more climate stories, check out the What on Earth newsletter. You can subscribe to have it delivered to your inbox every week. We drop two new episodes of What on Earth every week, so be sure to check your podcast feeds on Wednesday evenings as well as Saturday mornings. And while you're there, leave us a review. We love to read them. That is all for us. And the What on Earth team includes Vivian Luck, Rachel Sanders, Molly Siegel, Andy Mullins, Matthias Wolfson, and Catherine Rolfson. And special thanks to Fabiola Carletti and Missy Johnson. I'm Laura Lynch. Thank you for listening. That was a special Earth Day episode of What on Earth, the CBC's Climate Solution podcast hosted by me, Laura Lynch. And we'd love you to join our community of Earthlings by finding us everywhere you get your podcasts.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.